Hello, my name is Donovan Bigelow. This is an Introduction to Psychology series of lectures. First, I am a licensed mental health counselor, and one of the things I've found is that teaching psychology and doing psychology, being a psychotherapist, is a wonderful mix. I teach, I have to know the theory, I have to understand the theory and how to bring it to students. That theory helps me with my patients. It helps me understand their minds. And also bringing my patients, thoroughly disguised because of confidentiality questions, bringing my patients into the classroom in a way allows me to keep the teaching sort of alive and real and relevant. It's not cold, dead theory out of a book. It's not abstract. It hopefully is as relevant to your lives as it could possibly be. And the first question you're probably asking is, why study psychology at all? The answer to that question is deceptively simple. Have you ever messed up a relationship? Are you concerned about being a good parent? How is your relationships with your parents going? My sense is these are some of the most critical elements in your life, and that the study of psychology will be directly relevant to making those aspects of your life better. I would even want to add, how is it in terms of your relationships with your coworkers, your supervisors, your superiors? Is it as smooth as you want it to be? Do you understand what's going on? The way you can make your life better on the job and professionally is to understand what's going on inside of you first. That's the first step. Now, I used to think that students taking my class would very quickly see how fabulous a field this is, and they would dump their old career trajectory and dedicate themselves, like me, to the study of psychology. That illusion lasted about 30 seconds. I get that most of you, though you might find it mildly interesting, are not going to abandon your career track, your programs, and immerse yourself in the field of psychology. So most of you, I think, are here because it's a requirement of your program. I get that. I get that you're not going to be as committed to this field as I am, and I promise you I won't make it any harder than it has to be for you to get your grade, to get your checklist on your career progression, move out into the world to get a job. That's my goal, to help you do that. And before we go any further, the first thing you should have in front of you is a copy of these notes and the syllabus. Both of those are available through the website. The first problem with studying psychology is that change is painful. Everybody knows that. But psychologically, it's important that you understand the dynamic involved. If change is painful, nobody changes easily. Everybody recognizes that making significant changes in your life is always difficult. Most people understand. Most people know someone who's either got an alcohol problem or smokes too much, and they've tried to change, and it hasn't been successful, at least very often. So why is it that change is so painful? And here's the complication in an academic psychology class. Learning is painful because learning means change. If you learn something new, then something old that you've already understood has to be destroyed, let go, modified. And for the same reason, it's hard for anyone to make significant changes in their life. It's hard for students to learn new concepts, not just because they're complicated, not just because they're abstract in some ways. And I assure you, there are plenty of psychology concepts that are obscure and abstract and difficult. Plenty of that. But the real difficulty is not that. I'm going to challenge you throughout this course to recognize that it isn't just the complication of the words. It isn't just the complication of the ideas that make learning this material so difficult. Part of it, inevitably, it's a psychology class. I'm going to challenge who you are. I'm going to challenge your understanding of your very identity. The ideas that we're going to kick around in this class, in a way, and I don't think I can overemphasize this, are actually kind of threatening. To learn this material, to take it in, will require that you recognize the possibility that things were done in your life, that you have done things, that things have been done to you that have left images, left ideas, left fantasies that are almost indelible and very difficult to change. Nietzsche said, the great German philosopher from the late 1800s said, if a temple is to be built, then a temple must be destroyed. I think this is exactly what he meant. Now, it's not quite that dramatic. We're not destroying anything. But in a way, symbolically, to learn something new, especially something as challenging, as difficult, and as personal as psychology inevitably will be, one has to be prepared for some difficulty. Now, here's another problem. We're not only going to talk about some difficult concepts of self and self-development, but we're going to talk about subjects that are sometimes taboo in our society. We're going to talk about sexuality. We're going to talk about heterosexuality, homosexuality. We're going to talk about child development and how you raise your children. And if you've raised children, I may be saying things that run counter to how you've been taught. These are the complications in any psychology class that we're going to have to deal with. And I think if we deal with them up front and honestly, it'll make everybody's life, including mine, a little easier. Now, right off the bat, I've got to make an admission. I've got to confess something here. I teach psychology. I do psychology. As I said, I'm a licensed mental health counselor, and I have an active private practice in downtown Seattle, as well as teaching multiple classes of psychology. Now, what then is the subject of my study? The human mind. But what is the human mind? And I have to admit that no one, not Freud, not anybody since Freud, not all the scientists have come up, not all the philosophers have come up with an adequate definition of what the mind is. It's kind of embarrassing, actually. You have paid good money to take a very challenging course. You're going to work very hard, and you're going to get, hopefully, a very good grade. And I have to admit at the beginning that the very subject that we're studying, the human mind, has so far completely defined any scientific definition. What is the mind? And the answer is quite simply, we don't know. Freud, in about 1933, said, we have the brain, and we have consciousness. I think he meant the mind. And he said there's a gap between these two things, and our evidence doesn't show a direct causal link, a connection between the two in any direct way. And this is a phenomenal confession by a guy who'd studied the human mind more deeply than anybody else ever had before and possibly since. And so I struggle with keeping open to the possibility that the subject that I am teaching is actually evolving as we speak. I can describe what the mind does. I can describe how it develops, and I will. I will describe what happens when it goes bad, when there are problems, psychopathology, and I will describe the process and the methods for healing a wounded mind. We're fairly good at that now. There's been 100 years of good research, so we know what to do. But it's always at one step removed. There isn't a scientifically acceptable universal definition of mind. So we're going to have to struggle with that a little bit. I had a student not too long ago in the student evaluation section get very angry with me, and he was kind of outraged that I didn't have science backing up everything I said. And it's clear that I didn't spend enough time in that class explaining how it is that science, hard science, physics, chemistry, biology, mathematics, and the human sciences, psychology, history, literature, social sciences, sociology, how these interact. It's critically important that you understand that, frankly, they're closer than most people think. I'll get to that in a little bit. Perhaps to clarify things, we need to go back in history a little bit. It won't simply do for me to start talking about the current status of psychology, because where we are, when we are, and the particular form of our current culture has a history, and you can't understand where you are unless you've understood where you've been. And one of the things that's critically important is that we understand where this whole idea of what it means to be human came from and how it's developed over, let's say, the last 5 centuries. And I'm going to cite some scientists, some researchers, and some discoverers. And I want to go back to 1515 in Europe. As an aside, there's quite a bit of discussion today about culture and multiculturalism. We'll get to that in a little bit as well. But one of the bedrocks of psychology is that the study of psychology is the study of the human, and the human is universal. One of my underlying assumptions is that we're all of the same species, that we're all human, and that there is an identifiable, a reasonably articulable human nature that is the subject of my study. Yes, there are a lot of different cultures, and yes, they are fabulously interesting and worthy of study. But most of the time, it seems to me, and this is my prejudice, is the idea that these cultures do things differently a bit superficially, that it's a style question laid over a very foundational and consistent and universal human nature. I'm not going to minimize the importance of stylistic differences, and yet it seems to me the study of psychology has to be grounded on the assumption that all humans are the same species, and that the differences seem to be more superficial than not. And so when I speak of psychology or the human mind, I mean the human mind, not the white male European mind, not any other narrowly understood version of the human mind. I'm talking about humanity. My assumption is we're all human. And psychology as a field grew up in the West, so that's mostly what I'm stuck with right now. So let's go back to 1515, to the great Polish astronomer Copernicus. Now, Copernicus came up with a theory that everyone today understands, and no one today has questioned, and no one has questioned for hundreds of years. The Earth goes around the Sun. This is not news to any four-year-old in America today. But in 1515, it was radical, it was dangerous, it was blasphemy. Over the course of most of Europe, the Catholic Church had been in charge for several centuries. And the core of their theology was that God created man and the earth and placed it at the center of the universe so that man was, in some ways, the most special creature in the universe in the most special place, dead center. Copernicus, using astronomy, mathematics, proved for the first time that the earth does not move, does not sit at the center of the universe, that it rotates around the sun. Now, this was blasphemy. 60 years later in Italy, Galileo comes up with the same idea, and he's threatened with torturous death by the Catholic Church for such blasphemy. But here's where it starts. This is where suspicion starts, and a French philosopher named Ricoeur, in the 60s, I believe, came up with this phrase, the masters of suspicion. And I think what he was trying to get at was that there have been half a dozen men, scientists, over the last 500 years, who have called into radical question the fundamental assumptions that were driving the train for a long, long time. Copernicus is the first, and he called into question a foundational element of the Catholic Church's theology. So what, you might say? What does this have to do with psychology? Well, it's central, because what does it mean to be human? That's the subject of psychology. 500 years ago, what it meant to be human was human at the center of the universe, God's special creation. Copernicus and Galileo said no, and we were taken out of the center. And here's the critical first point. Imagine yourself a little Polish farmer out there plowing the fields, or a little Italian businessman wandering around Florence, and you hear about what your countrymen have discovered and mathematically proven. It's science, it seems, that the Catholic Church is wrong about this central position of theology. What's your next question? Put yourself back in that time and place. What's the next question that you would have? Naturally, it seems to me that it would probably be, well, if they got that wrong, what else did they get wrong? You would inevitably become a little more suspicious. Let's move forward to the 1840s and Darwin. Most all of you have heard of Darwin and the theory of evolution. The reason it's important for psychology is because this was perhaps, along with Sir Isaac Newton's theory of in physics, the three laws of thermodynamics, the most important discovery or theory in the last 2,000 years. It fundamentally shifted the sense of what it means to be human. Darwin came along and posited the idea that we perhaps were not created by God, but evolved out of lesser species. Now, let me make a disclaimer right now. You're going to learn a section in these lectures on evolutionary psychology. That is a relatively new branch of psychology. And I'll say this again later, but just so we're clear now, nothing about evolutionary psychology nowadays requires any threat to anyone's religious beliefs because of this. The evolutionary psychologists believe we evolve, but they don't talk about, because there is no way to tell scientifically how we got started. Either we evolved, as Darwin suggested, or God put us here. In either case, the evolutionary psychologists simply want to address and focus on and deal with what happens genetically from that point till now. So going back 2, 3, 4, 5 million years, it varies quite a bit. That's the subject of the discussion, and no one in my field now feels much need to contradict anybody's religious beliefs. We're satisfied that genetics and evolution have been happening for 5 or 6 or 7 million years, and for our purposes, that's enough. So Darwin takes us not just out of the center of the universe, but we're no longer, at least possibly, God's special children. Then something really scary happened. Karl Marx came along in the mid-1800s. Most of you have heard of Marx, socialism, communism, the Communist Manifesto. Most of you are vaguely familiar with what happened in Russia, the Soviet Union, China. China killed 72 million under Mao Zedong, killed 72 million of his own people. Stalin, under Soviet Russia, Lenin before him, probably was responsible for somewhere between 15 and 20 million dead people. And then there's Hitler and the fascists, which if you understand Nazi, the word Nazi is a shortening of the German phrase Nationalsozialisten, which means national socialist. So communist socialist, the underlying Marxist ideology behind the world's worst totalitarian dictatorships, is Marxist, and his idea of what it meant to be human was nothing more than this. You are a cog in the economic machine. You are a function of the economic means of production. There is no dignity to the human. There is no value to the human. You are simply a cog in the machine and may be replaced, especially if you don't agree with the political powers that be. So at this point, what it meant to be human had taken dramatic hits. We had gone from being in the center of the universe to God's special children to now we're almost fungible and have so little meaning. We're not only more and more suspicious now, we're starting to doubt the very nature of what it means to understand the truth. The Catholic Church understood dogmatically, and here's the key phrase, dogmatism. They had a dogmatic belief in absolute truth. If you didn't understand what that truth was, you simply had to ask the priest. He told you, and that was the end of the discussion. You believed, because that's the nature of the culture at the time. But as the hundreds of years kept going, and these scientists and theoreticians kept generating new ways of thinking, all of them had the same effect. They made it harder and harder for us to believe what was true, or what we used to think was true. We became suspicious to the point where we doubted everything. Oh, and then it gets worse. Then along comes Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche, a philosopher who may be the most important philosopher since Plato. I've studied him for 30 years. I think I know him fairly well. He said 13 books worth of things, but one of the things he's most famous for is God is dead. Now, he didn't mean the deity has expired or anything like that. He was also himself a bit of a scientist. He understood that he didn't have evidence of that. That's not what he meant. It was a cultural commentary. What he meant was that we don't believe in God the way we used to. As a cultural artifact, God appears to be dead compared to the dogmatic truth of the Middle Ages. And I can challenge everyone in the classroom watching this video now. I can challenge you with a simple test to prove that he was right. You don't have to answer out loud, just answer this question to yourself. Those of you who have religious beliefs, and I don't care what they are, Christian, Buddhist, Muslim, doesn't matter, Jewish, doesn't matter, ask yourself this question. Those of you who knew your grandparents, knew them at all, isn't it true that they were more devout than you are, whatever your religion was? In the vast majority of classes where I've asked that question, the answer has almost universally been yes. So that even in the two generations, between now and two generations ago, it appears that this dynamic started by Copernicus is continuing. We are even now continuing to lose our belief in dogmatic truth. And after Nietzsche, along comes Freud in the early 1900s. And what Freud does in his 40 years of research and 23 volumes of writings, One of the key things he does for the purposes of our introductory lecture is that he expands on an understanding of the unconscious. And this, in some ways, is the most devastating of the transitions from a belief in truth and a sense of self that's grounded in objective reality. This is one of the most disturbing things, because what he's suggesting ultimately is we don't even know who we are. It's one thing not to know what's going on in the outside world a little bit, but he fundamentally objected to the idea that our conscious mind was where all the action was. And he wasn't the first one to come up with the idea of the unconscious. Nietzsche talked about it. Aristotle and Plato were struggling with it. It's been discussed for a long time, but no one up until Freud had researched it, had delved into it, had developed a method for trying to get at the specifics of what's in the unconscious. And no one before Freud recognized the amazing power of the unconscious. Most good psychotherapy today seems to me to be focused on that recognition, that in order to change in psychotherapy, you must get at the unconscious dynamics that have dogged people throughout their lives since earliest childhood. For our introductory purposes, what this does is it's as if we're playing with wild cards in a poker game. Lots of wild cards. How do you even know yourself? It's one thing to look outside and sort of take measurements and scientifically look at what the world's doing out there. But what Freud called into question was our ability to know ourselves at all. And without that, the rest of it seems almost impossible. He had some answers for that, which we'll get to later, but that's where we are now. One last person came along, a French philosopher named Foucault in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And he represents a movement, I guess you could say, socioculturalism, this idea that it's not about external reality, it's not really even about internal reality. He postulated, and a lot of folks have followed him down this road, the idea that what's really important about what it means to be human is where and when you're born. It is the culture you're born into that makes you who you are, and you have almost no power, authority, ability to get outside your own culture. He postulated not a fundamental human nature, but a fragmented humanity broken into small cultural enclaves that inevitably are in conflict with each other and seem to be, at least the way he thinks about it, fundamentally different. So it's hard to imagine how much lower we could fall from where we came from. And the word that French philosophy left us with is called deconstruction. We've gone from dogmatic belief in truth to deconstruction. And what they mean by that, I believe, and it's complicated, is that there is no such thing as truth. There can't be any such thing as truth, given the masters of suspicion and the constant tearing up of what we once thought was true. And it seems like every generation, more of what we thought was true is now on the dustbin of history. And they took a position that, give up, there is no reason to try. Deconstruction is the idea that instead of trying to understand the truth of the world and ourselves, let's just tear apart, let's deconstruct anyone who claims any such nonsense. Now, here's the problem. This is the problem for a psychology class and a psychology instructor. What am I supposed to do with that? I cannot claim that I know the dogmatic truth, because we've come too far. The masters of suspicion have done their work too well. On the other hand, do we go down the road of French philosophy? Deconstruction? How could you possibly get out of bed in the morning if you thought that was true? If there was no truth, if there was no objective, ascertainable reality, how could you make a decision what to wear on a given day? Much less what to do for a career, how to take care of your children. And that's the key to me. As a psychology instructor, I cannot accept either of these false dichotomies. No, I don't have the absolute truth. I have to admit that. But on the other hand, this idea of deconstruction does us no good at all. And I know that's wrong because I've raised children. And I know it makes a difference how you raise your children. I know that what you do counts and it affects them. And if you get it right, it's better than if you get it wrong. Now, what is right and wrong? I get to ask that question as a psychotherapist. I get to ask that question as a psychology teacher. And I may not have an ironclad dogmatic answer, but I want to be able to move in that direction I want to be able to find useful ways of thinking about child development, about sexuality, about our identity as humans, and the quality and nature of our relationships with each other. So that's my fundamental assumption in this class. We're not going the dogmatic truth route, but we're staying away as much as we can from French philosophy and deconstruction. And I think most of you intuitively understand that. You must have the basis for making decisions, a principled basis for making decisions. You can't just make them randomly. They have to be based on some sense of a coherent identity. And I think psychology is in a place right now where we can say, a little bit humbly, but we can say, we have the ability to recognize a human identity, how it's put together, how it functions, and we can help people do that, and we can help them when it goes wrong. One more point. I'm going to get into a series of lectures on theories of psychology. Most of them are grounded in the past. Child development, psychoanalytic history, behaviorism, even cognitive theory. They all tend to look at what's going on right now, but mainly what's been going on in the past. How did we get here? I think psychology deserves better. I think there's one of these theories, the humanist or the existential humanist, that is a school I was actually trained in that I think brings something extra to the table that I want this class to bring as well, and that's an eye toward the future. You need the basis or principled basis for making good decisions that help you grow, that help you get stronger, that help you love better, work better, raise your children better. So the focus on the past is necessary, but it won't do simply to focus on the past and what parents did to children. We have to look toward the future as well, to the creation of meaning. It's possible that the masters of suspicion have done their work so well that we no longer have much faith in government, in religion, sometimes even families. Doesn't seem like there's much faith in any of that anymore. And so what we are left with in a psychology class is looking inside and perhaps taking responsibility for the creation of meaning ourselves. That may be a large order for a psychology class, but I think that's in the background and we have to recognize it. One last point in terms of the big picture. I've also taught history, and one of the things that seems to me is that we go through cycles. It seems to me that every nation gets founded, rises, peaks, declines, falls, and something else takes shape after it. I've recently discovered an Italian philosopher from the 16th century. His name was Vico. And he noticed this as well with his studies, that there was a theocratic age, an age of religious dominance, and then an aristocratic age with knights and kings and princes taking over. And then there was a democratic age. Even back then, he understood the sort of flow of democratic history. But after that, he postulated a chaotic age, which then brought us back to theocracy. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but it seems to make sense to me, and it allows us to wonder about where we are as a culture and allows us, I think, and here's my hope, that if we know where and when we are, and if we know where we are in the flow of history, perhaps that will help us identify more clearly who we are, how we can relate to each other in a way that's actually useful and effective. And it may be more than a basic psychology class should have, but it's hard not to keep in mind some of these background things. This isn't going to be like a mathematics class where we have calculations, and they're discrete. They're within a tiny little section of mathematics, and that's all we have to know. No psychology class has the luxury of doing that. We're human. We're complicated. We're messy creatures. One of the things that sort of shocked me not too long ago was I realized, wait a minute, we're not only numbering our world wars, we're not only having world wars, we're numbering them. Now, everyone's known about World War I and World War II, but stop for a minute, sit back and go, wow, think about what that means. We're not only having world wars, we've had so many we've started to number them. We are a messy creature. We're not simple. We're not easy to understand. And we're a little bit dangerous. maybe we're a lot dangerous. I'm hoping the psychology class that you're about to embark on will help you manage that process. I don't think we can change human nature, but forewarned is forearmed. And if this class helps you make better principled decisions that make your life better, then we're going to call it a victory. Okay, where do we go after 500 years of philosophy and history and some psychology? We have to start with Freud. It's pretty clear that in the last 110, 20 years, a lot of things have changed. But virtually all of the changes that have taken place in my field of psychology all go back to Freud and what he started. So let me talk for a few moments about Freud. There have been lots of rumors, lots of criticism, a lot of misunderstandings about Freud. And my challenge to you in Freud criticism is to first go back and read Freud before you criticize him too much. I think today Freud is very little read and very much criticized, and those two things are unfortunate. He was not a cocaine addict. Yes, he tried cocaine, but they had a very different kind of cocaine back then than we had. It was just discovered. And back then, doctors and even some nurses, when they had new medication, they tried it on themselves because they didn't have human testing regulations the way we have today. And as soon as he realized it wasn't a very good anesthetic for his purposes, he stopped, and he was never an addict, and he was never writing his psychoanalytic theory while he was high on cocaine. I don't know how that persists, that rumor persists, but it simply factually isn't true at all. So about Freud, let me make a little a comment about where he fits in the last century. Most people wouldn't naturally think of him as much of a feminist. In fact, in the 60s, the feminist movement spent a fair amount of ink criticizing Freud and his handling of female patients. But I'm going to go out on a limb here and say they were simply misguided and, in fact, wrong. Freud, I think, was the first feminist. This sounds ridiculous to some people. But he was the only doctor in Europe that took women seriously. The big psychological problem in Europe in the late 1800s was hysteria. And the word hysteria actually goes back to a Greek derivative, and it means wandering womb. And what they assumed was only women could be hysterical because women were just basically weak, the constitutionally inadequate, high-strung, easily susceptible to hysterical problems. And it was misogynistic. It was grossly unscientific. Freud was the first to say, wait a minute, none of that makes any sense. Let me listen to my female patients. And he stopped with prejudice, and he actually tried to figure out what was going on inside the minds of his female patients. He was the first, and for a long time, the only doctor in Europe to do that. And I'm reminded of Sir Isaac Newton's statement when someone said he was, Sir Isaac, you're so smart. He said, and I quote, "If I have seen farther than others, it is because I have stood on the shoulders of giants." He gave credit to the scientists who came before him, who laid down the basics upon which he built. I think people that criticize Freud today forget that if we can see farther than he can, and we, I think, quite assuredly can, it is in large part because we remain standing on his shoulders. And it seems, if not disingenuous, at least unappreciative, to acknowledge our debt to him, however far we've come since him. One of the ways, let me get back to the subject here, one of the ways that Freud handled his own struggle with dogmatism versus deconstruction, his own recognition that over the course of 500 plus years, we no longer were quite so secure in our statement of truth, he relied on the hard sciences. He began as a neurologist, dissecting brains and trying to figure out a physiological explanation for human behaviors. The problem was, after he wrote his first major treatise, The Project for a Scientific Psychology, he realized it didn't work. And he put it in a drawer, and he never published it, and it was published after he died in 1939. It was written in the late 1890s. And what he was trying to do was establish a biological, possibly genetic, though genetics were very rudimentary back then, basis for understanding all human behavior. The problem was he kept dissecting the brains of crazy people, the insane, the hospitalized when they died, and he couldn't find anything wrong with them. It made no sense to him, but he did something that very few scientists have ever done. When the evidence didn't agree with his theory, he changed his theory. Charcot, a French neurologist in Paris who Freud studied under for some time, was a very great influence on him. And Charcot said, theories are great, but they don't stop things from existing. It's an important idea. Most of the time, most doctors, and I think today even, here's the scary part, psychotherapists who have a particular theory of mind, whatever it is, cognitive behaviorist, psychoanalytic, whatever, if they see a patient who doesn't go along with their theory, they blame the patient, as if it's the patient's fault, as if the patient's resisting or not paying attention or actively trying to undercut the doctor. This is absurd. Freud was right about that, and he spent his entire career changing his theories as he took in more data, more clinical experience. He developed a method. We can call it the phenomenological method. He tried as best he could to not front-load theory. He tried to be free of theory. In a subsequent writer, a guy named Bion, Bion said, without memory or desire, we should address our patients. That seemed kind of crazy the first time I read it. But what I think he meant is that we cannot impose our theories on our patients. We must learn from our patients. We must let them tell us about their minds. We must pay attention to our patients. Freud was the first to do that, and certainly the first to take women patients seriously. Now, I'm going to go out on another limb here, maybe a dangerous limb. Okay, so you all understand that we've gone from dogmatism to deconstruction, that the idea of truth is sort of now a little passé. But wait a minute. Don't we believe in multiculturalism and diversity? Well, of course. Those are the new sort of key values that we all value, that everybody says that they're in every academic institution's key statements and mission statements and goals. But what happens? And let me just ask, as Nietzsche said, a dangerous question. What happens if our modern values are just the result of this 500 years? What if multiculturalism and diversity are just symptoms of cultural collapse? What happens if they're symptoms of individuals, psyches, who no longer can believe anything? They no longer can believe in themselves at all, so they have to believe in someone else. Believe we must, it appears. But this idea, and I'm challenging received wisdom here. I want you to think critically, even about the most sacred ideas we have in academia today, and politics, frankly. I'm going to ask the question, and I do think it's a dangerous question, is multiculturalism and diversity merely a symptom of a decadent, nihilistic French philosophy that has been building for 500 years? Is there something useful there, really? Or is it a symptom we need to step back and question? Maybe this is the last great act of suspicion, even calling into question those things. This is going to come up over and over again, and I want to keep it on the back burner at the very least. So we're back now. As a psychology instructor, what am I supposed to do with this? I can't tell you the truth, because I don't know it, but I can't simply spout French philosophy and not believe in anything. So here's what we're going to do. This is how I approach this class. This is sort of the bedrock assumptions of this psychology class. I may not have the truth, but I can approximate the truth. And I can search for the truth. I may know that I'll never reach it, but I know that trying to head in that direction, I know that approximating the truth as best I can with my meager skills and talents and theories puts me in a better position, makes me stronger, makes me able to make decisions that help my family, myself, my colleagues, my friends, better than either dogmatism or deconstruction. So at the end of the day, the theories I'm going to teach you have to be addressed to this question. Are they useful? I don't know if they're true or not, but I will not teach anything I don't find really, really, really useful. And I hope you find them useful. One of the ways around this problem, perhaps, is focusing on the method. Nietzsche, again, said, all great truths are methods. So this phenomenological method that Freud laid down. The idea that we sit and listen and we try to, with some honesty and objectivity if we can, struggle toward that anyway, listen to our patients and try to help them help us understand their minds. That's the method that may help us find some useful truth. And I want to keep a very sharp eye out for theories that justify prejudice, because that's what I see them doing most of the time. We grab on to a theory because it makes us feel better, because we pretend we know stuff. And I'll get to this a little bit later, but I want to warn you up front that the theories are theories. They're a way of looking at part of the human mind, a way of looking at some functions of the human mind. And if they're useful, great. And if we grab onto them too quickly, if you want to know the truth too intensely, I challenge you to be aware of that. See how you feel about these things. Do you feel the burning need to know these things so that you can get over this anxiety and know things? That may be a problem, not a solution. I've had students who studied themselves almost to death trying to memorize the theory, and my sense was at the end of the day it didn't do them a lot of good. On the other hand, I have struggled for a decade, more than a decade, quite a bit more than that actually, to come up with an introductory to psychology course that generates theories that are in fact useful. None of this should be abstract or theoretical or academic. I'm going to struggle as best I can toward a useful truth for you. It is up to you to make it real inside your own heart. Last thing on that. Freud did have a response to the postmodernists 70 years before the postmodernists wrote. And he said something about, in his scientific sort of way of thinking, that we may not be able to know the full truth of the external world, but you know what? We either were put here by God or we evolved to explore the real world. It can't be that the human mind is incapable of exploring the real world. He had an idea called the reality principle, and he believed that there was an objective reality out there and we could get close to it. He also had the idea of the pleasure principle, and this runs counter. We want to avoid pain. We want to increase pleasure. But as you all know very well already, before I say a word about psychology, that interferes very frequently, let me think, on a daily basis, with our ability to perceive reality. What we want, what we need, what we fear, what we love, what we hate, these things don't allow us to very clearly recognize reality. We have illusions. And we are all, in some degree, Freudians now, because everyone listening to this tape knows when someone says, "Oh, she's so in denial," everyone knows what they mean, but that's a very specific Freudian term created by Freud to recognize the power of the unconscious, to recognize the difficulty we all have distinguishing between reality and our own subjective experience. One of the ways that I help my patients, and one of the ways I think I've been able to help my students a little bit, is with this simple idea. Inside, when you're struggling with an idea, follow the aliveness. Follow the aliveness within you. Is the theory something that excites you, something that sort of resonates with you? Do you have a sense that this is meaningful, useful material, that it helps you make sense of the world and your relationships? I would caution against just abstract theorizing. Be mindful of your inner experience of these ideas as we kick them around the classroom. As Freud said, and I believe he was right about this, we are designed to explore the real world, and the mind is inconceivable, a human mind is inconceivable without the tools necessary to go a fair way down that road. And maybe the flip side of that same idea, yes, it's true, we're subjective creatures. I'm in my head, you're in yours. We can't ever know someone perfectly. Everybody's been disappointed in relationships. That fact is obvious. But there's something about that subjectivity that makes us try to get into the real world, that our living in the world is subjective, but we have to master to some degree what the real world is in order for us to survive at all. So the subjectivity, in a way, doesn't run counter to recognizing external reality, it may very well be our most profound motivation to find it. All right, now I have to say something about science. I mentioned already the student who was irritated by my not doing enough science. The problem is, science doesn't give us very many answers in psychology. Now, I'm a big fan of science. I do believe, since Newton, it has given us all of the creations, all of the technologies that make our life better than most lives have ever been on the planet. So science is good. No critique of science. But I'm reminded of a story by the existential psychoanalyst Erwin Yalom. He wrote a book. He's written a dozen books. But he told a story once, and I thought this was very useful. He told a story of two men walking down a very long, dark alley. There's only one little spotlight, one little street light in the middle. And they get to the very end of the dark alley, and one guy checks his pockets, and he says to his friend, "Oh my goodness, I've lost my keys. We need to go back in the alley and check." And he, the guy that lost the keys, goes back to the street light, and he's looking around underneath the light. And his friend comes back and says, "Dude, what are you doing? You could have lost them anywhere along the big, long, dark alley." And his friend looks at him and says, quite simply, "But this is where the light is." Now, I think the light is science. Science can shine a light on the human mind, but the human mind is a long, dark alley, and most of it doesn't lend itself to scientific methods. So that's the balance we have to strike. And I think, I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb here as well, even scientists today are a little more humble about what they know or claim to know. Two things going on now. Quantum mechanics, the study of subatomic particles. It turns out that Max Planck, great physicist in the early 20th century, and a guy named Heisenberg, who developed his uncertainty principle, recognized that at the subatomic particle level, we could not observe. The act of observing electrons, protons, neutrons, subatomic particles rendered those particles differently, affected our ability to look at them. We couldn't see without affecting what we see, therefore we were never sure what we're seeing at the subatomic level. And the first time I read that, I went, wait a minute, that's psychology. We can't look inside the human mind. And so it turns out that quantum mechanics is about mathematical probabilities. Well, psychology is about probabilities, probabilities of human behavior, probabilities of causation and correlation. And then I started doing some research on astronomy, going the other way, from subatomic particles to astrophysics. And it turns out, much to my surprise, the theorists have said that there's a supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Now, I don't know what a supermassive black hole, I don't know what a medium-sized black hole is. But it turns out, it seems, that the laws of physics don't apply to black holes, which means we don't know what they are, and we can't describe them, and we can't see them, because they don't emit any light, because they're black holes, and it sucks up all the light and energy in the area. So we have no idea what they are, and we cannot identify them, and none of our technologies and our theories allow us to explain what they are. And I thought, that's a lot like psychology. So it seems to me that scientists are a lot more humble these days, and the differential between science and psychology is a great deal less than it perhaps used to be. And that leads us to how we know things. You can know things academically, mathematically, intellectually. In psychology, we mostly know things intuitively. And Robert Young, he's an author I'm sure you'll read a great deal of, he wrote an article that had to do with knowing versus knowing about. And by that he meant, and this is a critical distinction in a psychology class, I think it's a critical distinction for psychotherapy patients, actually. You can know about things. And by that he meant know about them academically, theoretically. Know about them from books. Or you can know about it the heart. You learn from experience. It's like you can know what sexuality is like by reading lots of books on sexuality. But until you actually have a sexual experience, I don't think you do anything more than know about that. You have to have experience that evokes in you an unconscious emotional resonance. And I can give a lot of fancy words to this experience, but I think without any more, you already understand the difference between knowing and knowing about. And what I have to do in this class, for the most part, is help you know about the theories of psychology. And that's a useful thing. It isn't either or. It has to be both. And this is a little aside you'll hear again and again. Most of the dichotomies that we have are false. In most instances, an either-or proposition ends up being a little bit of both is the right answer here. And so I think that's what this is about as well, knowing versus knowing about. I have to teach the theory. You have to learn the theory. There's no question about that. That's what the test is going to be about. But I want to add that until you know it from experience, until when I'm, for example, discussing child development and I describe how children are now understood to develop a functioning mind, you will, I almost promise, have experiences in the classroom where you go, oh my God, yes, that's right. That makes sense. Now I get it. That, ladies and gentlemen, is knowing from here. So my focus will be a little bit of both. We're going to learn the theory, but my hope is through the use of clinical case examples, through the use of the dialogue in the classroom, through the use of perhaps some stories that might be useful from literature and life and history, that you will more often than not resonate with these theories and combine the knowing about with hopefully a good chunk of knowing as well. All right, now I have to get to the theories. Preliminary. Around the turn of the 19th century, there were two primary schools of psychology. There was the structuralists and the functionalists. They're not much talked about these days, but just a tiny little bit of background. The structuralists thought of the mind biologically, in some ways similar to a car engine. They wanted to take it apart, look at the pieces and parts, put it back together, and see how it worked. A good theory, made sense. You could probably do that to a brain to some degree, but the study of the mind escaped them because you can't take the brain apart and put it back together and have it function again. Mostly the folks who think structurally these days are the psychiatrists, the neurologists who deal primarily in the medical model of the mind. They still think that Freud was onto something early on, that biology, genetics, the neuronal structure of the brain is still the key to understanding human behavior in the mind. They're still arguing about that. The other school back in the day were the functionalists. Structuralism, functionalism. Functionalists didn't care what the structure was. They just care how it functioned. They just care how it worked. They sort of took a deep breath, and this is a little bit like what Freud did right at the beginning. He took a deep breath and said, you know what, the brain thing's not working for me. Let's figure out what it does. Let's figure out how to affect what it does. And it seems to me that the bulk of psychology in the last 100 years has inevitably gravitated toward that in the absence of an honest and accurate and universally accepted theory of mind. So that's how it started. And over the course of the last 100 years, we have now about 7 major theories in psychology. Now, it depends on which theorist you talk to. You could probably come up with 70 or 7 or 12 or 15. Probably if you ask 10 psychologists what their theories are, you're going to get 15 different versions because half of them are going to change their mind halfway through the question. However, I think in my field I can say, oh, that's another thing. When I teach something in this class, by and large, what I'm going to try to do my very best in good faith is to teach you what my field says is the consensus opinion. Now, if we can't even clarify scientifically and clearly what the mind is, you must recognize that all the other theories are going to be inevitably all over the map. So my job is to teach what the consensus is. I will, if my field as a general rule agrees on something, then that's what I'll teach. If there's a significant minority opinion, I'll throw that in. If we're scattered and all over the map, I'll try to be clear on that and not pretend my field is as consistent as perhaps I wish it was.